Right, so this time I do have a text, so this won't take more than about 35 minutes for me to deliver, so we should have plenty of time afterwards for Q&A. You've each got the handout, the second handout? Good, okay. So what I'm going to present today is a case in favour of Britain's fighting between 1914 and 1918. The case was first articulated in the fourth chapter of my book, and there are some flyers about the book on the table there if that interests you. But then wanting to get my oar in before everyone else got going on the First World War, I published an article in the Right of Centre monthly current affairs magazine Standpoint last September under this title. You may have noticed that Michael Gove created some waves in January when in the Daily Mail he published an article decrying left-wing historians' denigration of British contribution to the First World War. Presumably you noticed that. Okay, I'm proud to say that he cites me as an authority in his article. As a consequence of that, it was pointed out to me that in March, Richard Evans, one of Michael Gove's bêtes noires, and Regius Professor of History at Cambridge, wrote an article in the New Statesman, which of course is left of centre, in which he described my views as absurd. Yeah, but he's a Cambridge man, so what do you expect? Okay. So at least you know... That's where I stand. Daily Mail, New Statesman, take your pick. Before I get going, I'm going to hold a poll, as I always do when I talk in these matters. You are, of course, a rather niche constituency, but still. You have three options, and you have to vote. You can't abstain. Three options. Option one, it was right for Britain to fight from 1914 to 1918. That's your first option. No. I give you all the options, and then we hold the poll. That's option one. Right to fight from 1914 to 18. Second, right to fight in 1914, but not until 1918. In other words, peace should have been made sometime before 1918. And third, wrong to fight at all. Okay. Those of you who go for the third option, raise your hand. Okay, good. Okay, one brave soul there. Fine. I last did this at Christchurch, where the audience was perhaps less sympathetic as a whole to the military than you might be. But still, of 30 people, I think only 5 raised their hands to support option three. So the second option, is it was right to fight in 1914, but probably not until 1918, that peace should have been made earlier. Any takers there? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So, fine. So eight think should have made peace before 1918. And then those of you who think that it was right to fight from beginning to end, raise your hands, please. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So, 13, 8, and 1. Okay.
It's a fourth option if we're ending 45.
That's getting far too sophisticated. Okay, fine. Well, I'll at the end of the session, I'll hold another poll to see whether what I've said has had any impact. I want to measure my impact. All right. So, as you know, I'm an ethicist. I'm not an historian, although my first love was, probably still is, history. I read a lot of history books, partly because I want my ethics to be sufficiently realistic that they're plausible. However, because I'm an ethicist, I'm less shy of making moral judgments than historians. I find that if you ask historians moral questions about the First World War, they tend to be kind of mealy-mouthed, to use a Scottish expression, kind of equivocate. You get a sense of what they think, but they don't quite say it. Anyway, I'm not shy, because I'm an ethicist. I make moral judgments. So what I'm going to do is to mount, as I say, a case in favour of Britain's being right to go to war in 1914 and to stay at it until November 1918. And the argument will operate in terms of the criteria I set out in the earlier session this morning. Just to remind you, this is an important point. As I said, and as Tim said too, a just war is a war that is justified overall. It's not a pure war, right? So a war being a complex and usually fairly prolonged event involving lots of decisions and actions will have morally flawed parts. And it's a very interesting and not terribly easy to answer question as to when a part that is bad has so infected the whole that the whole should stop, right? So, for example, let us suppose that the dropping of bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was wrong. What does that imply for the Allied effort as a whole? I guess that's happening near the end of the war. It doesn't make sense to say it should have stopped, because it almost had stopped. But that's it. That's the question. When does a part so vitiate the whole as to make it unjust? Okay, just to remind you, I gave you a whole list of criteria of just war this morning. I'm only going to focus on four of them for our purpose, because I think these are the ones that bear most directly on Britain's involvement in World War One. And these are, first of all, just cause, namely some grave injustice, the rectification of which is sufficiently important to risk the hazards and costs of war. Secondly, as I said, it's not enough for the grave injustice to be a pretext for war. It has to be, the rectification of this injustice has to be what the war intends. So in going to war, I intend primarily, there may be other motives too, but my primary motive is to rectify this injustice. Then third, before embarking on war, political leaders have to consider whether it's proportionate, whether war is an apt means for achieving the intended political end, whether it'll be counterproductive, whether the injustice it wants to rectify is grave enough to warrant the costs, whether we can afford the costs. And then finally, at least finally amongst the criteria I will focus on, is that once war is launched, military commanders also have to proportion military means to military ends and not incur military or civilian casualties unnecessarily, inefficiently or wantonly. And of course, in the First World War, that's a very controversial issue, because what makes most people hesitate before saying we are right to fight are, of course, the enormous costs. You know, just think Somme, right? So just cause, right intention, proportion in going to war and proportion in the waging of it. These are the ones I'm going to, these are the criteria I will deploy to try and get a moral grip on Britain's involvement in the First World War. So first of all, just cause was the one, and what was it? If you've been reading the newspapers over the last 6 months, you'll have picked up that historians disagree about who to blame most for the escalation of war in 1914 from its local Balkan beginnings to a continental and then a global conflagration. Up until very recently, the dominant consensus endorsed the view first articulated by a German historian called Fritz Fischer in the 1960s, the view that Berlin was primarily responsible. So German historian Fritz Fischer, his thesis propounded in the 1960s was that Berlin was primarily responsible. And that consensus has dominated historiography even in Germany until quite recently. Again, if you've been listening to the radio, I guess about 2-3 weeks ago, 9:45 every morning on Radio 4, you would have heard Christopher Clark talk out of his book, The Sleepwalkers. And Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers, has challenged the Fisher thesis. Clark wants to spread responsibility more broadly, particularly toward St. Petersburg and also to Serbia. Clark concludes his book by saying this, and I quote, There is no smoking gun in this story, or rather, there is one in the hand of every major character. The outbreak of war was a tragedy, not a crime. The crisis that brought war in 1914, he tells us, was the fruit of a shared political culture which rendered Europe's leaders sleepwalkers, watchful but unseeing, haunted by dreams, yet blind to the reality of the horror they were about to bring into the world. End of quote. Now, I mean, that's how the book ends. It's a very ringing, memorable image. Sleepwalkers, watchful but unseeing, haunted by dreams. I just note that at the end of the book, all the major players are sleepwalkers. At the beginning of the book, Clark starts off by distancing himself from what was the fashion when I was studying history in the 1970s, to regard the First World War as a tragic event that just happened because of impersonal forces. I mean, A.G.P. Taylor's thesis that basically it was the railway timetables that couldn't be rearranged. That's what led to the war. Or it was imperialism, if you were a Marxist. So in other words, impersonal forces caused the war. But more recently, I think historians have said, no, we need to focus on human agency, individuals. Decisions were made that shouldn't have been made or might have been made differently. And Clark starts off beating that drum, but by the end of the book, everyone's a sleepwalker. As I probably subtly indicated, I don't buy Clark's argument, not because of its history, but because of its ethics. First, he says, the war was a tragedy, not a crime. And I say, something could be a tragedy, not a crime, but oftentimes crimes have tragic dimensions, right? If we reflect on ourselves and things we've done wrong, or read stories about other people, there are sometimes factors beyond our immediate control that if they don't make us do it, that they certainly incline us to do certain things. So my point here is that there may have been a certain tragic element to the First World War, one of which was that the German High Command had contingency plans for attacking Russia without attacking France, but hadn't updated those plans since 1909, so they couldn't use them. So when the Kaiser ordered his commanders not to attack France, but to attack Russia only, von Moltke, the chief general, said, Kaiser, we can't do that. So, tragic that someone had left the 1909 plans on the shelf. But the point here is that the Clark's sharp dichotomy between tragedy and crime is too overdrawn. There can be a tragic dimension and yet still wrongdoing, things that shouldn't have been done. In addition, Clark wants to spread the blame, which is fine, and I think that's probably quite right, that you can blame, you can certainly blame Vienna for deciding to wage war on Serbia. Why? Well, because Vienna gave Serbia an ultimatum, and much to Vienna's disappointment, Serbia agreed on almost every point, and yet Vienna invaded anyway, right? So I think that's right. You could apportion blame, but my riposte is, well, the fact that we can spread blame broadly doesn't mean we have to spread it equally. The fact that blame spread is wide doesn't make it even. Fortunately, the business of trying to figure out who's to blame for the escalation of war from a local Balkan event to a European-wide war is enormously complicated because lots of different agents making decisions. Fortunately, my task this afternoon is not to sort that one out. It's not to give a moral assessment of the First World War as a whole. My more modest aim is to decide whether or not the British government was justified in going to war in August 1914 and staying at war for 4 years. And that involves making a moral judgment about Germany's invasion of Belgium, Luxembourg and France, because without that invasion, Britain wouldn't have fought. So, why did Germany invade Belgium, Luxembourg and France? She invaded because she feared that France would attack in support of Russia. Well, according to just war reasoning, the mere threat of attack is no just cause for war. Only if there is substantial evidence that a threat is actually in the process of being realized. So it may not be a mature attack, but it is an attack in process. If that's the case, just war reasoning says you can launch a preemptive defense. You don't have to wait until the enemy cross your border if you know they're about to. So a preemptive war is justifiable. What's not justifiable is a preventative war that you launch simply because you fear at some point those guys over there are going to attack you. So you can't launch a just war simply on the grounds of a speculative threat. So what's the situation in August 1914? France was not intending to attack Germany. Indeed, the French deliberately ordered their troops to stay 10 kilometers behind the French border to signify to Berlin that they were not preparing to attack. Notwithstanding this, Germany declared war on France on the 3rd of August, claiming that French troops had crossed the border and French aircraft had bombed Nuremberg. Early on this year, I happened to be having a conversation with a young German woman historian who works for the Open University, Annika Mombauer, who has published on these things, and I thought I ought to test this. I said, so is it true that French troops had crossed the border and French aircraft had bombed Nuremberg? She said, no, it's not. Never happened. Germany's reasons for invading were a pretext. Okay. So it was the German government, dominated by its military leadership, that launched a preventative war against France and Belgium in August 1914. Why? Because as social Darwinists, they took it for granted that war is the natural way of deciding the balance of international power, because they foresaw that the longer the next war was delayed, that the longer would be the odds against Germany's victory, and because, and here I quote David Stevenson at the LSE, because the memory of 1870, which was when Prussia beat France first, the memory of 1870, still nurtured through annual commemorations and the cult of Bismarck, had addicted the German leaders to saber-rattling and to military gambles, which had paid off before and might do so again. Okay. The important point here is that dominating certain reaches of German leadership was this social Darwinism, the notion that international life is a struggle for survival and dominance, and war is the natural way of surviving and dominating. And that as far as Helmut von Moltke, the chief of the German General Staff, was concerned, the sooner Germany went to war against France and Russia, the better, because the longer it waited, the stronger Russia would become. So as early as 1912, he made clear he was looking for a pretext to go to war. So as I said, Clark's metaphor of sleepwalker is a powerful one, and it does pick out, as it were, some important tragic features of the situation in the run-up to the outbreak of war in 1914. But sleepwalkers, let's be clear here, a sleepwalker is a metaphor here, and all metaphors are both like and unlike what they're referring to. So Germany's leaders were not literally sleepwalkers. They were fully conscious moral agents, making decisions according to their best lights in a volatile situation of limited visibility. In such circumstances, which aren't at all unusual, error was forgivable. General point here, some years ago I read a book by Timothy Garton Ash about transatlantic relations called Free World, and as with most books I read these days, I can only remember one sentence. But it's a good sentence, and it says something to the effect that one thing we all need to take on board is that our rulers know what they're doing only half the time. Now, at this point I pause for dramatic effect, and people usually sort of giggle as if to say, well, of course we all knew that, to which I then respond in a slightly reproving fashion, saying, no, don't giggle as if you do any better, because you wouldn't. Because anyone who's run anything at all complicated, any institution, knows that for a lot of the time you're simply trying to keep the damn thing together and on the road, and you hope to God you'll get past this next day or two and it'll work. But it's sellotape and string and whatever. And if that's the case for me running a university department, Lord knows what those in charge of national governments have to cope with. So, you know, Germany, you know, if you look back at what happened in diplomacy leading up to August 1914, mistakes were made. I mean, I read today in the papers that, you know, the British Foreign Secretary, Edward Grey, apparently the Russian ambassador said to him that Russia was mobilizing in defense of Serbia. And Grey perhaps unthinkingly said, that's a perfectly natural thing to do, giving the Russians the wrong impression that that Russian mobilization had British blessing, which it didn't. But, you know, who knows what went through Edward Grey's mind at that moment. Maybe he was thinking of something entirely different, and this was just an offhand remark. And there's also something else about a muffled telephone conversation that was apparently decisive. So these are tragic elements, but you're dealing with human beings who are having to operate in a fog, then as now. So, you know, I think we need to be forgiving. However, as a Christian, I can't be forgiving of social Darwinism. It is against everything I believe in about the world. I think it's wrong. I think it's inhumane. I think it's cynical. So I won't forgive. Let it be said that social Darwinism wasn't entirely absent from British intellectual life either. But certainly von Moltke was, and Bethmann Hollweg, I think, lost his Christian faith in the... Bethmann Hollweg was the foreign minister of Germany, lost his Christian faith, such as it was, in the early 1900s, and became a social Darwinist. So, you know, worldviews do matter in terms of foreign policy. Okay. So, it might be perfectly natural for a nation not to want to see diminished its power to realize its intentions in the world, as I think it is. I think it's quite reasonable for a nation to want to retain power, particularly if you think that, you know, if you think your nation stands for something worthwhile, then you would rather have the power to promote those things than not. Why not? That's fine. But if social Darwinism thinks it natural for a nation to launch a preventative war simply to forestall the loss of its dominance, just war reasoning doesn't think it right. You can't go to war just because you want to remain dominant. Just cause has to consist of an injury, be it actualized or in the process of being actualized. And in August 1914, Germany had suffered no injury. So, Germany's invasion of France and Belgium was without justification, morally. So much for just cause. In sending troops to the continent to aid France against Germany in August 1914, what were Britain's intentions and were they right? Well, in Britain, a majority of the government's cabinet was against entering the war as late as the 2nd of August. We almost didn't. The Entente Cordiale with France only formally committed us to consult with the French in the case of a threat to European peace. It did not automatically activate our joint military contingency plans. So we weren't formally committed to defend France by treaty. However, the Foreign Secretary Edward Grey argued strongly that even in the absence of formal treaty obligations, we were morally obliged to come to France's aid. One of the reasons being that we had, we had assured the French that in the event of German invasion, the Royal Navy would defend their northern ports. As a consequence of which, the French Navy was nowhere in the Channel. Okay, so there had been discussions and a certain amount of military coordination and certain policy decisions made, but we weren't strictly obliged by treaty. Though Edward Grey said we were morally obliged. But then what was decisive was Germany's violation of Belgian neutrality when it crossed the border in the 4th of August. In British minds, Belgium conjured up a variety of causes, some, as it were, purely moral, others morally national interested. So Belgium to the British connoted a treaty to maintain the independence of Belgium, to which both Germany and Britain were signatories. We were responsible for guaranteeing that. Belgium also represented a small nation, the underdog. Of course, Belgium also represented British national interest. It involved national security, since the Belgian coast faced London and the Thames estuary, and it had long been British policy to keep that coastline free from hostile control, to prevent invasion and preserve command of the sea. So, it's quite true. In rising to Belgium's defence, the British also sought to forestall a German domination of Northwest Europe that menaced our security. But as I've said, not all national interests are immoral, and this seems to me to be one that is unobjectionable. But what's morally crucial, I think, in this is that Britain did not initiate a preventative war to maintain a favourable balance of power. So, of course, like every other nation, then as now, we are concerned about the balance of power. You know, I imagine not many in this room would be terribly happy if China came to dominate international relations, or Putin's Russia, for example. So we're rather concerned that Chinese and Russian power be balanced or countered. Nothing wrong with that. But we can't go to war just because we want to get the right right level of domination. And nor did we go to war on August the 4th in order to do that. So, in sum, Germany had suffered no actual injury, nor was she under any actually emergent threat of suffering one. Unprovoked, she launched a preventative invasion of France and Belgium to assert and establish her own dominance. In response, Britain went to war to maintain international order by vindicating the treaty guaranteeing Belgian independence, as well as to fend off a serious and actualized threat to its own national security, in which its interest was legitimate. Therefore, I think Britain had just cause and right intention. Which brings us to the issue of proportion. Given all we now know of the appalling cost of resisting Germany, was it not disproportionate? In other words, would it not have been better for Belgium, France, Russia and Britain to have suffered domination by Germany instead of resisting it? How bad would it have been to let Germany win? Well, judging by the peace programme of war aims framed by Bethmann-Hollweg, the German foreign minister, in September 1914, and judging by the terms of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk imposed on Russia by Germany in 1917, German domination would have been what I call seriously oppressive. Those are my adjectives. See if you think the facts warrant the description. So according to the September programme, Germany proposed to annex Luxembourg, major Belgian cities, including Liège and Antwerp, parts of France, perhaps including the Channel coast from Dunkirk to Boulogne. In addition, France was to be subjected to a crippling indemnity, preventing rearmament for 20 years, and to a commercial treaty that would make it economically dependent on Germany. Belgium was to become a vassal state under military occupation and, in effect, economically, a German province. Although the September peace programme of 1914 was not actually an authoritative policy statement, it was, in fact, moderate compared with the more extreme annexationism of the military and the circles around the Kaiser. And certainly its peace terms envisaged for France were less harsh than those actually imposed on Russia in 1917. At Brest-Litovsk, Russia was made to sign away a third of her population, much of her heavy industry and coal production, and her best agricultural land. So, clearly Germany was out to grab and retain territory and resources and to stay there. In addition, we can infer from the behaviour of the German military towards civilians in 1914 the ruthless character of post-war German domination, especially in those regions subjected to military occupation. Certainly people of my generation grew up with stories of German atrocities in the First World War, and since the 1960s, I guess we've all become sceptical. These were myths, some of them probably were. However, when I taught at Trinity College Dublin, two of my colleagues there, John Horn and Alan Kramer, were busy writing histories documenting German atrocities in France and Belgium. And as they've shown, it was German military policy to use civilians as human shields in combat, to burn villages in collective reprisal for resistance, and to shoot local irregulars caught bearing arms. Between August and October 1914, well over 6,000 civilians were deliberately killed by German troops in Belgium and France, and a further 23,000 forcibly deported to German prison camps. Don't think I mentioned that here, but John Lewis Stemple published a book recently about the plight of Allied prisoners in German prisoner of war camps, in which he makes the observation that at certain periods the chances of surviving in a German war camp, prisoner of war camp, were less than those of surviving in the trenches. Now, what I haven't been able to find out is that implies that prisoner of war camp was not a good place to be for prisoners. But there is one question I haven't thought about, that is to what extent the plight of prisoners was a consequence of the Allied blockade which starved Germany. So it may not have, it may not simply be a sign of German brutality, but that's, I think I've mentioned Stempel's book on your handout there. Had Russia, France and Britain not resisted 1914, therefore, it seems to me there's good reason to suppose that Germany would have dominated Western and Eastern Europe in such a rapacious and ruthless manner as to have stoked widespread resentment and among its newly subject peoples and high alarm among the newly menaced British. It seems to me that domination of the kind that Germany would have exercised would not have been a recipe for peace. It would have ushered in an era of civil unrest and even more acute international tension. In short, non-resistance in 1914 would have produced neither a just peace nor a stable peace. Now, it's true, of course, that had Britain stayed out of the war, as Niall Ferguson argues, it should, in his famous book, The Pity of War, and in his recent TV programme, had Britain stayed out of the war, she wouldn't have suffered, we wouldn't have suffered German domination in the way that France and Belgium would have. We would, however, have suffered a heightened threat to our security. Well, arguably, that would have been tolerable and preferable to the horrendous costs of fighting a war. But what this reading doesn't take into account, however, is Britain's responsibility as the still preeminent great power for maintaining international law and order and for the vindication of the unjustly invaded and grievously exploited. And how would France have felt? How would you have felt if you were French? And besides, it seems to me, for us not to have fought in 1914 is... would probably have just been to delay the war with Germany, not to avoid it. Okay, this gets us to the most obvious moral controversy about the First World War. A war can have just cause. It can rightly intend to stop and reverse injustice, and it can be proportionate in offering belligerent resistance, and yet still be disproportionate in the means it chose to resist with. So whatever the rights and wrongs of Britain's going to war in 1914, it was the massive number of casualties suffered at times for no obviously significant military gain that shocked Britons in 1914-18 and shocks us now. Above all else, this is what damns the war in the eyes of many, the apparently futile industrial-scale slaughter and the general's dogged, criminally callous persistence in it. Right, so this is the lions led by donkeys thesis, and the Blackadder view of British generals, stupid and callous. Right, let's start with the numbers. By the way, does anyone here regard the war against Hitler as unjust? I think that's unlikely, but possible. Okay, fine. That's important because this next part of my argument depends on you regarding the war against Hitler as just. Because the form of the argument will be, if you think the war against Hitler was just, why don't you think the war against Wilhelm and Germany was just? Okay. Right, start with the numbers. The war against Wilhelm and Germany cost Britain and the Empire roughly 1,115,000 military deaths. So 1.1 million, roughly. This was a dreadful, unprecedented, and mercifully unsurpassed cost. And when we compare it with the 568,000 British and Imperial deaths in the Second World War, which lasted longer, that makes the First World War and our fighting of it look profligate, wasteful. Shorter war, double the casualties. So it looks as if our fighting in the First World War was profligate, disproportionate. But appearances deceive. The casualties suffered by other major combatants in the First World War were far higher than Britain's. France lost 1.6 million dead. Britain's casualties in the war of 1939 to 45 were flattered by the fact that we never fought on the main front. First of all, we were on the main front. Second World War, the main front was in the East, right? Where the cost of defeating Hitler to the Soviets was 10.7 million military deaths. And the same number of civilians, 20 million. So the point is, we got off very lightly in the Second World War because we weren't on the main front. So the comparison with the First World War figures is actually, a straightforward comparison is not appropriate. Nevertheless, Britain's losses in 14 to 18 were appalling. Why? Controversial question. Since the 60s, the view has been military incompetence plus callousness. Today, however, military historians, I think, are generally much more forgiving. They point out, and I'm thinking here of Gary Sheffield, among others, that British officers in 1914, British army officers, were trained to run small colonial forces and fight small colonial wars. By 1916, they were having to run armies of millions. So is there any surprise if there was a measure of incompetence? Because the officership had to get used to a rather different way of waging war. What's more, we had the misfortune to fight the First World War at a certain stage of technological development. That's to say, after the invention of barbed wire and the machine gun, and before the invention of the tank. In other words, we were compelled, because the Germans had invaded France and entrenched themselves, we and the French were compelled to take the offensive against an invader at a stage of technological development that smiled upon defence, and had, you may remember, the United States fought its civil war in the 1860s, and that cost 600,000 American military fatalities. That was the first kind of industrial war, or proto-industrial war. Had the Americans had the misfortune to delay their civil war by 50 years, just for technological reasons, their casualties would have risen into the millions. So there's a tragic element. Without doubt, the feature of military conduct during the First World War that most excites moral indignation is attrition. It's this notion that these stupid generals could think about throwing lines upon lines of cannon fodder at the enemy, and that really they were just lacking in imagination as well as care for their own people. So this tactic of attrition, the tactic of wearing down the enemy's forces faster than he wears down one's own, has seemed to many to be a rather boneheaded and immoral way of waging war. And if boneheaded, immoral, profligate, wasteful, disproportionate. But again, I think appearances deceive, because wearing down the enemy is a reasonable aim of military endeavour in situations where a decisive breakthrough can't be achieved. And you can wear down the enemy more or less carelessly or carefully. It can be done efficiently. During the First World War, British generals and government ministers strove to find ways to break the stalemate on the Western Front and to overcome the need for prolonged attritional warfare. That's why Gallipoli was launched, to try and get round this endless mincemeater of a war on the Western Front. And that's why Douglas Haig championed the development of the tank, which he did. He had hoped to deploy it at the Somme, but for political reasons he had to fight the Somme earlier than he wanted to. And also, here I depend entirely on people like William Philpott and Gary Sheffield in interpreting what happened at the Somme and Haig's generalship. I think popularly we tend to think of Haig as having been committed to this wasteful attritional war at the Somme, whereas in fact, I think, ironically, it's the reverse. As I understand it, a number of British generals had come to the conclusion by July 1916 that there was going to be no breakthrough and that therefore we should settle down to perhaps a more efficient way of waging attritional warfare, but the sort of bite-and-hold tactics. Haig's error was not to settle for attrition. He wanted breakthrough. So for the Somme, for example, he had his artillery cover not simply the first line of trenches, nor the second, but the rear trenches, in the hope that he might be able to break through the whole lot. But the consequence of that was that the effect of his military, of his artillery, was dissipated, which is one reason why the front line, the front German line, was not destroyed by artillery. So the irony is, it was Haig's, as I understand it, it was Haig's refusal to accept attrition that led to the, partly led to the Somme disaster. Now, can you blame him for that? I mean, some of his brother officers had already settled for attrition, but, you know, can you blame him for wanting to try and break out and to avoid it? If he hadn't tried, we probably would blame him. Besides, those who damned British generals for waging attritional war and tolerating high casualty rates for months on end had to reckon with the fact that the undisputed turning point in the later war against Hitler, the Battle of Stalingrad, was horrifically attritional, its human cost rivaling that of the Great War battles. Also, they have to take on board the fact that on the mercifully few occasions in the Second World War, when British soldiers found themselves bogged down in the Normandy bocage or in the hills of Italy, they reverted to the attritional tactics of the First World War. And the casualty rates in the 44-45 campaign in Northwest Europe equaled and sometimes exceeded those on the Western Front. Almost at the end here. So, I think a good case can be made that Britain had just cause and right intention in going to war against Germany in 1914, and that her belligerency was proportionate. Notwithstanding, I mean, looking back, one can see that Haig adopted tactics that were more wasteful than they should have been. So there was an element of disproportion there, a disproportionate part. Okay, but the question is was the intention to rectify Germany's unjust invasion of France and Belgium Britain's main motive for continuing to fight the war until November 1918? Did she continue to fight with the right intention of reversing Germany's unjust aggression? Or did she come to use that just cause as a pretext for waging her own aggressive war of continental domination? And this was the substance of Siegfried Sassoon's protest. Remember, 1917, he protested. He didn't protest that the war should never have begun. He protested it was being unnecessarily prolonged, and that what had begun as a defensive war had become an aggressive one. So was Sassoon correct? More precisely, could Britain have negotiated a sufficiently just peace and stopped the dreadful slaughter before 1917? Could we have made a reasonable peace before 1918? It seems not. And here, I depend entirely on what David Stevenson has written. Germany showed no sign of being willing to return Belgium or France to the status quo ante until October 1918. In the winter of 1915-16, when it was clear that the war wasn't going to end anytime soon, there was an informal diplomatic exchange between Germany and Belgium, in which Germany demanded the latter's alignment with German foreign policy, Belgian disarmament, German occupation and transit rights, a coastal naval base, and German majority shareholding in Belgian railways. So, not much concession there. At the end of 1916, which of course was after the four-month slogfest of the Somme, which according to at least one senior German officer bled the German army dry, at the end of 1916, Hindenburg and Ludendorff actually expanded their annexationist demands. They didn't reduce them, they increased them. In April 1917, the Kaiser and the German High Command endorsed a set of proposals according to which Germany would annex Luxembourg, the iron ore fields of France, whole Liège and the Flanders coast for at least a century, and even as late as September 1918, Germany still resisted surrendering Belgium. It was only in early October 1918 that Germany offered to enter peace negotiations on the basis of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, the seventh of which required Belgium to be evacuated and restored. In sum, then, I think there is no evidence that Britain could have secured satisfactory peace terms before October 1918, and Siegfried Sassoon himself admitted in 1945 that, quote, in the light of subsequent events, it is difficult to believe that a peace negotiated in 1917 would have been permanent, end of quote, to which I add, it is even more difficult to believe that remotely acceptable peace terms were actually on offer. So, to sum up, in my just war analysis, all things considered, Britain's war against Germany from 1914 to 1918 was morally justified. It had just cause, the unprovoked, preventative German invasion of Belgium and France. Its intention, both ad bellum and in bello, was right, to expel a menacing invader who wouldn't countenance voluntary evacuation until the very end. It was proportionate in going to war in that the failure to resist would have resulted in grave oppression in Belgium, Luxembourg and France, the entrenchment on the Belgian and French coast of a direct threat to British security, Germany's confirmation in bad habits of ruthless military aggression, and a consequently fragile peace. Finally, yes, Britain's war was sometimes disproportionate in the course of waging it, where the military strategy and tactics adopted were more expensive of troops' lives than necessary, and yes, sometimes the generals, not least Haig, should have known better, in retrospect. But war, even when just overall, is only ever waged by imperfect human beings, and strenuous efforts were made to render attrition ever more efficient and to overcome the need for it altogether by making a decisive breakthrough, as was eventually achieved in 1918. Meanwhile, the enormous costs in men and materiel were in fact affordable because they were in fact afforded. And in that sense, the manner of Britain's waging war was proportionate. I rest my case, my lord. Sorry? Yeah, let's have some Q&A first, shall we? Have we got 5 minutes for Q&A?
Let's take 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. So, just to make clear, as an ethicist, I depend on the history I read here. I've done no original historical research. And so if some historian points out I've made a mistake in the reading of the history, then my argument has to change. I did, Hugh Strawn, look through that, an early version of the chapter which that's based, and seemed to think it was sensible. So, what was that?
Can you read it back?
Oh, yes. Okay, so was the Allied blockade of Germany just? Was it discriminate or indiscriminate? You go straight for the awkward questions, don't you? I haven't considered that. And I need to consider that. Some people, people often say that economic sanctions or blockades are alternatives to war, but it's not quite clear because the damage can be almost as bad. And yes, the damage is inflicted on the civilian population. But you shouldn't, I guess, the moral rule is one should not intend to kill civilians, whether that means you can't intend to degrade the quality of their life, is a nice point. I guess the other controversial point is that we continue to blockade after the armistice, until the peace treaty was signed. I guess the argument there was, well, until Germany has signed the dotted line, we ain't relenting. But I don't know enough about the facts or the motives of the blockade to know. But no, that is an important question. But then, of course, arises the question, well, suppose we think it wasn't justified, does that mean that the whole Allied effort was unjustified? So, parts and wholes again. And people, yes, you kept sort of cavalry divisions in the rear. People laugh at him for that, but apparently the cavalry, when they were used, which wasn't very often, were actually quite effective.
In 1918, Breakthrough
Day. Yeah. Just while we're on Haig, we mentioned Patton. I think Tim mentioned Patton, saying he never wanted to be taken to a field hospital again. The question of whether Haig was callous, I understand I've checked in the diaries. Immediately after the Somme began, he visited a number of field hospitals. I checked, at least in the parts of his diaries that published, after the first few days he doesn't do it again. His son, I believe, has reported, and I don't know how reliable this is, that his officers pleaded with him not to visit the hospitals because it so upset him. So, I guess if one's going to be a military commander, emotionally one has to, as I put it, callous oneself or hide from oneself the effects of what one does. But then that's not entirely foreign to more ordinary parts of life. That if I'm an employer and I have to sack you, maybe you've done something wrong, or maybe I just can't afford to pay you, I may know that this will throw your family onto the dole. I don't like to do that, but in a sense I can't take responsibility for the whole of your life. My responsibility is to this business, and I have to let you go. I may do it as unbrutally as I can, but my actions will have effects that are not happy effects, But in a sense, I can't own all the effects of my acts. I have to limit my responsibility. I think what's going on with military command is similar. You know, Haig didn't rejoice in what this was doing to his troops at all, considering very, very much. He still thought he had to do it. Anyway, that's often Haig. Mark, I think you had a question. Two things. I've not read the book. I've had it on my shelf for years. You may have heard of Margaret Macmillan, who's just published another book about the outbreak of war in 1914. She made her name when she published a book on the Versailles peace negotiations. I believe her thesis is that the terms imposed in Germany were not as draconian as is often supposed. Second thing is, we're talking about the connection between 1919 and 1945, or the connection between Iraq in 2003 and Iraq in 2014, history doesn't move in straight lines. Historical causation doesn't move in straight lines. In other words, between Versailles and 1939, lots of other things happened. It wasn't all Versailles. People made decisions. The great economic recession happened. It can't all be blamed on Versailles. So there's no simple causation. There are multiple causes. And you know, so the British throughout the 20s and 30s actually thought the French had been vengeful at Versailles. One reason many of us tended to be rather sympathetic to Germany in the 1920s and 30s, even the 30s, because we felt the French had been rather nasty. And I understand that, except, you know, maybe we don't appreciate it. If we'd had our country invaded for the second time in 45 years and had just lost 1.6 million dead getting the buggers out, a certain robustness in response is not inappropriate. But, yeah. Okay. I think there's two more questions. I think Charles...
I just asked exactly the question.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right, okay. There was one other question, I think. Yeah.
I was just going to say, as the one person who raised half an arm at the vote at the beginning of this session, it was half an arm because I thought you'd prefer that to a spoiled battle. Afterwards, I'm not absolutely sure.
Yes.
Scrolled over it.
Yes.
I have a judgment.
No, that's to me the $64,000 question. The question is how. Okay, the question is how bad does it have to be before you think this is just not worth it? I don't know. I just don't know. The only way I can answer it is in terms of is in political terms. So there comes a point where pursuing a war is just no longer politically sustainable. So to some extent, the answer is you reach the limit when the population at large will not stand it anymore. But morally speaking, how much is justice worth? So to take us on to controversial territory, I know most people think that the effects of the Iraq war in 2003 have been an unmitigated disaster. I disagree. I think the results have been very mixed. But let's suppose you agree that the fact that the Kurds are flourishing as never before, notwithstanding the last 3 or 4 weeks. Okay, so the Kurds no longer have to worry about being gassed. How much cost is their freedom worth? Give me a figure. Can't do it. Don't know. Puzzle. Maybe Peter can answer. Okay, so the question has to do with the Christmas truce and how, between the Germans and the British and how we read that. In what you said, I detect one mistake. Soldiers don't normally hate the enemy.
Sorry, soldiers?
Don't normally hate the enemy. I've read testimony from the First World War, R.H. Tawney. I've read testimony from the Spanish Civil War, George Orwell. And there's one other place too, I forget where it was. Anyway, this is of frontline troops commenting that when they go back home, they find the civilians back home have a hatred for the enemy that those in the trenches don't have. Tawney's own view was this is a nasty necessity. I don't regard that Fritz over there is morally responsible. He's doing what his superiors are telling him to do. He shouldn't be doing it, and I'm going to stop him. But that's it. So I don't think there are certain kinds of war, particularly when there's a big cultural difference, or particularly when the enemy is unscrupulous. that can elicit hatred, but not as a rules.
Okay, so you've got soldiers not hating each other,
yeah,
and so an element of peace, meeting no man's land. Is that opportunity to actually assemble to get a grip of the situation and stop the war if the troops want to fight?
Well, I guess, you know, I guess if the German soldiers, as they were, universally had upped and walked back home, that would have been the end of the war. As long as they were stuck there.
They had no choice.
Well, they did have a choice. They could have upped and walked and taken the consequences. So there's everyone's choice. Some choices are not very good ones.
Yeah. Well, the French did this. They sort of mutinied, but...
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Just before I finish, rather than do a three-part poll, has anyone changed their mind since I began talking? Hands up. You're still entrenched. All right. No clear impact then. Okay.